Welcome to Crazy Good Turns. Our goal is to celebrate people who do good deeds, big or small. We discover our stories through research and with help from you, our listeners. Visit our website at crazygoodturns.org/submissions to tell us about a person or organization who's done something great for someone else, and they could be featured on an upcoming episode. As always, thanks for listening.
The people just didn't know about it, or people knew about it and they didn't talk about it. They were hiding kids in the closet. They were sending kids off. They were treating kids as stupid. And many of these kids were ending up in jail because left uncontrolled, they're uncontrollable. And if nobody is working toward helping them, they become a real burden. And as I said before, it's debilitating financially, emotionally. It just takes, and it destroys a family. If you don't have a way of dealing with it, it's going to have an impact on your life and the life of not only the husband and wife, but the spouse, the children as well, the other children as well.
That's Bernie Marcus, the 88-year-old co-founder of Home Depot. He's talking about how autism was treated in the late 1980s, before he founded the Marcus Autism Center, now one of the largest and most respected facilities for autism research and treatment in the world today. Bernie also co-founded the well-known advocacy and research group Autism Speaks. His commitment to the cause isn't based on any firsthand family experience with autism, as you might expect, and his motivation might surprise you, but not anyone who's ever crossed paths with Bernie. This is Crazy Good Turns. We tell inspiring stories about people who do amazing things for others, and I'm your host, Brad Shaw. Okay, full disclosure here. I worked at Home Depot for 11 years as head of communications before retiring in 2015. Our co-creator and executive producer here at Crazy Good Turns is Frank Blake, who was the CEO at Home Depot and my direct boss for most of my time there before he retired around the same time. Frank knows Bernie really well and considers him a friend and mentor. I've only met Bernie a few times, the most recent in our studio for this interview a few weeks ago. Don't worry, this isn't an episode about Home Depot, although the story Bernie tells about its founding is pretty funny. Frank and I wanted to feature Bernie's philanthropy, his own crazy good turns, because they're just that, crazy. And it's not just the amount of money Bernie gives, which is a ton, but rather how he does it that really sets him apart from many of today's billionaire philanthropists. And it started in his childhood.
Well, I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, which back in the 1920s, was a pretty great place. Poor. We lived in a fourth-floor tenement, but I loved the place. There were 1,000 kids all over the place, had lots of friends. Since we didn't have anything, my parents were Russian immigrants who came in, so I'm first generation. They were hardworking. My father was a carpenter. Now, that's really interesting, my father being a carpenter. He would be proud if he was alive today, knowing what happened with Home Depot. But we lived the life there, struggling through life, but we had family. I had two brothers and a sister and a lot of love in the house, and we managed. My mother was the matriarch of the family. She was great. She was always trying to convince you that you could be the best that you could be. You could be anything you wanted to be. She also believed, you know, which I do today, that America was the golden land. They had come from Russia. They saw the worst of the world. My mother and her father. My father came from Ukraine, my mother from Russia. And they saw the worst. And so they believed that this country, if you really put your nose to it, you could be anything. She said, you could be president. You could be president one day. God knows I would not want that job for anything in the world. But this is what she believed.
Bernie's mom and his Jewish faith instilled in him the importance of taking care of others.
We're Jewish, and we're brought up with this thing of tzedakah. It's a Hebrew word, means giving back actually, and it's part of our heritage. It's part of who we are, Jewish people are. I mean, if you look at philanthropy in the United States, I think the percentage of Jews in the United States is less than 1%. If you look at the amount given to philanthropy, it's probably 15 to 20%. Mm-hmm. So it goes to show it comes with the territory. Yep. That's who we are. And so I was even brought up, even when we were poor, my mother would, you know, having ice cream or what we call a Charlotte Russe, that was a big deal. And many times she would say, you can't have it because we have to give for trees in Israel, or there are poor people that need the money more than we do. And so I learned early on that that's what you do. And I just thought that's what you do.
Bernie had an early propensity for medicine. He graduated from pharmacy school in 1954, tried his hand as a pharmacist for a while, but ended up working in retail in New York. By 28, he was overseeing a $1 billion merchandising department for Two Guys, a large discount retailer at the time. He eventually became CEO of Handy Dan, a home improvement retailer on the West Coast. There, he struck up a close friendship with Arthur Blank, who went on to co-found Home Depot with him.
Arthur and I were fired. I was CEO of a company in California called Handy Dan. Arthur was the CFO, and we did not get along with the company that owned most of our shares. We were a public company, and Arthur and I got just dumped out on our ears one day. It was a horror story because, you know, we had actually built that company from four stores up until 80 stores, and it was a really very profitable company. And you don't expect to be fired when you're doing a great job. It didn't quite work that way. And we were fired, and naturally, I'd never been fired in my life. This is a new experience for me, kind of down in the dumps. And Ken Langone, who was a major investor in that company, Handy Dan, when I called him to tell him that this terrible thing happened to me, he said, "My God, you've just been hit in the ass with a golden horseshoe." And I said, "What in God's name do you mean by that?" I was despondent. I was really unhappy with this. And he said, "Why don't we open the store that you told me about?" And I had told him about this store that I had in my mind. I never explained it to him fully. He said, "Don't explain it to me." And I said, "No, I'm not going to, because this store is the store of the future." And he said, "Well, let's put some money together and let's open this store." And I recruited Arthur, and we got the investors. And so it's all in the Built from Scratch book, which is a great book telling the story of how Home Depot really started.
The year was 1978, and the idea was simple but groundbreaking.
All of the stores, like Handy Dan, at the 30,000 square foot stores that carried a very limited supply of everything. The top brand of this, the top brand of that, three hammers, four saws, things like that. But it didn't really satisfy the building trade or anybody. You couldn't build a house out of those stores. You couldn't do a real job out of those stores. You still had to go to a paint store, a hardware store, a plumbing store in order to get everything that you needed. And my concept was to put everything on the one roof, to buy directly from the manufacturers, cut out the distributors, and take that money that you would normally give to distributors and cut the prices, the lowest prices ever. And we were in many cases 35% below the market. And then the coup de grace was putting qualified people on the floor of the store. And I'm talking about people who were plumbers, who did this, craftsmen, carpenters, in the aisles to teach people how to do. Well, this is a new thing. People didn't know how to do it themselves. If a toilet overran, they would call a plumber, and it cost them $85, $90 for a $2 job, a $3 job. So we actually built the do-it-yourself business, which is kind of a miracle. It started slowly. People began to understand it, and then we had classes.
So when you told Ken you knew this was the store of the future, did you have any clue or idea that it would truly be what it is today?
I hate to tell you this, but yeah. I was thinking in terms of 1,500 stores, and people thought I was crazy. Arthur thought I was crazy. Ron Brill, who was our CFO at that time, he thought I was nuts. But I always thought that, yeah, we would have about 1,500 stores. Little did I know how I underestimated how many stores we could have.
Today, Home Depot is the world's largest home improvement retailer with just over 2,200 stores in North America. But back in the late 1980s, it was still relatively small with around 100 stores. At the time, Bernie had a personal accountant not employed by Home Depot, and he noticed she was wrestling with issues with her young child.
She was a young woman, and she had a child, and the child was about 4 years old and was non-commutative at all. And she would always say, "I have to go to a doctor, see the doctor for my child." And she would have a pile of books, a pile of reports, blood tests, all those kind of things. And she would come back destroyed because nobody understood how to take care of this child. The child was not commutative, had severe behavioral problems. And doctors were not trained to take care of a child. We didn't know what the child had. I had never seen anything like it, and I fortunately never exposed to that in my own family. So I began to ask questions. Are there people like this? And she said, my God, you have no idea. There are people all over that are like this, different varieties. It's not like the same thing over and over again. They're all different. And I began to get interested in that. And I said, is there any place in Atlanta where you can go to be taken care of? She said, there is no place whatsoever. She said, there is no doctor I can go to. There's nobody that's qualified to take care of this child.
The child had autism, a term that's been used since the 1940s, but in the late 1980s still had little awareness, advocacy, or treatment. In his travels around the country, Bernie began visiting the handful of autism centers that existed to see if he could create something similar to help his accountant's child back in Atlanta and help others with autism along the way. He was particularly impressed with the work at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, hired the guy running it, and opened what was then called the Marcus Developmental Resource Center in 1991 to treat children with autism.
And we opened in two trailers I put side by side on the Emory campus. And we opened, and by the fourth week, we were inundated with hundreds of people. We had two psychiatrists working, and they just couldn't deal with it. It was impossible. So we found a bigger place, and we moved to a second location. And there were not hundreds, now there were thousands coming to us. And we ended up eventually building the Marcus Autism Center on a piece of property we were able to buy.
Many wealthy business people, when confronted with a problem like that, would say, let me fly you up to Boston and I'll cover all your medical bills, for example, as opposed to how do I start something that's going to fix this problem? What was your motivation at that point to do so much more than just help this one individual?
I think it goes back to my upbringing and the fact that I didn't grow up in wealth and the fact that I worked all my life. Opened Home Depot, I was 50 years of age when I opened. So I had worked for people all my life, and I recognized how important the well-being of the people were that worked for me. It was just a case they hit a clock and they came in and they were just numbers. They were human beings, and I'm concerned about human beings, and I've never changed. This has been my philosophy all my life. I love the people that work for me in my life. I really did, because I am who I am. I'm a product of all the hard work that they did. I happen to be very fortunate that I'm the recipient at the end of the game. But believe me when I tell you that I never could have reached where I am today had it not been for these great people around me. So she was important to me. And just sending her somewhere wasn't going to work. Number one, she couldn't afford it. Number two, she couldn't travel back and forth. So we either had to have it here or nowhere.
It was the blending of two things at Bernie's core: his deep desire to help people in need, and his love of building things from scratch. He calls it entrepreneurial philanthropy, and it defines his giving philosophy to this day.
I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I mean, I love to open new things and do new things. So this was a new thing, how to make it the best, how to make it most effective. And I think we've reached, you know, part of that today. We certainly haven't gotten the end of this journey.
Bernie says the early days at the Marcus Autism Center were challenging. The lack of awareness about autism made it close to impossible to raise money. Bernie footed the bill personally to keep the operations afloat, barely.
Between $5 to $7 million every year. I couldn't get anybody to help it in any way, shape. I'm talking about city, state, other philanthropists. And many times my board would say to me, you've got to close this place down. And I would go down there to close the place down, and invariably, it always happened when I walked in, some woman would come running over to me and tell me that we basically saved her life, that if it hadn't been for the Marcus Autism Center, that her life would be over. And wow. They typically told me the story of their life. Number one, it had taken every cent that they had taking care of this child. Number two, in 80% of the cases, the husband left the wife alone. That this woman, single woman, was now fighting this struggle with a child 24 hours a day. It's an emotional, financial burden. And you know, it just, how do you close something like that? How do you do it? I couldn't do it. And every time I would go back and say, no, we're keeping it open another year and another year, another year, it became another year, another year, another year. And then finally, one year, the ultimate happened, and that's Children's Healthcare of Atlanta came in and said, you know what, this belongs under our wing, this belongs under our umbrella, and they took over because it was the running of it and the hiring the people. Because I'm not qualified to do that. I could tell you about selling a hammer, a chainsaw. I could do that, but you know, dealing with a child and dealing with his life and the whole family's life is well beyond me. And Children's Healthcare of Atlanta basically saved that institute.
Tucked into the established infrastructure of Children's Healthcare, the Marcus Autism Center was now stable, well-funded, and growing. Bernie and the team at Children's knew they were doing important work treating thousands of children a year, but wanted to find a leader who could take the center to the next level in autism research, diagnosis, and treatment. And they found Dr. Ami Klin. Klin was born in Brazil, his parents Holocaust survivors. Prior to joining the Marcus Center, he spent 20 years at Yale as director of its autism program and was a professor of child psychology and psychiatry. World-renowned in the autism community, Klin and his team were developing cutting-edge eye-tracking technology to diagnose autism in increasingly younger children, which is critical to effective treatment. Bernie was instrumental in recruiting Klin to Atlanta. Here's Dr. Klin.
Prior to meeting Bernie, I sent him and some other folks in Atlanta an 11-page vision statement of what I dreamt of accomplishing here. When I arrived in Bernie's office, he was there to greet me with those 11 pages, and they were covered with notes and yellow highlights. And we spent, my recollection, maybe three and a half hours together as we discussed each one of those points, and he was impressed with the possibility of really changing the world for children with autism and their families. And he noticed still some hesitation in my voice, and then he turned to me, "Ami, you would be a schmuck if you didn't come to Atlanta." And guess what? He was right.
I'm a salesman because I worked on the floor of the stores and you sell. And I was trying to sell him on this thing. I said, "Listen, Atlanta had so much to offer because it was everybody in Atlanta wanted him here." And I'm talking about the CDC. I'm talking about Emory University. I'm talking about Georgia Tech. I'm talking about the University of Georgia. I'm talking about Georgia State. There were so many entities that wanted him here, that were interested in this problem. And he had something here that he didn't have in Yale. And I said, "Ami, you don't take this job. You're the biggest schmuck in the world." And it just came out of my mouth. And little did I know that stuck with him, really stuck with him. And he thought about it. He still talks about it today. But we're so happy that everything that we said came true, that all of these places did cooperate, that everybody did join in.
Klin became the center's director in 2011. And under his leadership, it has twice been designated a center of excellence by the National Institutes of Health, something only a handful of facilities achieve. The Marcus Center treats nearly 6,000 patients a year, and in the last 4 years has impacted more than 200,000 kids through its in-school and community outreach programs, and has trained more than 500 professionals across the country. Dr. Klin has co-authored a study on eye tracking in infants that experts say could be a game changer in early diagnosis and treatment of autism.
We have been able to accomplish what was truly the vision of Bernie when he created the center in 1991. He wanted for the center to provide not only the very best clinical care and supports for children and families. We wanted us to become architects of our community so that we change the lives of not only the children who walk through our doors, but all children. And he felt, like he did in his own business, that innovation was critical. So he also empowered us to not only create the leading science in the field, but to ensure that that science achieves tangible benefits for children and families, not in some undefined future, but now. And that's the vision that we are actualizing.
All told, Bernie has committed well over $100 million to autism. Again, a cause that didn't impact him or his family directly. This includes $25 million in seed money to co-found Autism Speaks, today the world's leading autism science and advocacy organization. Dr. Klin says Bernie's impact on research and treatment of autism is profound.
Bernie has been one of the most influential advocates on behalf of individuals with autism and their families. But even more than an advocate, he has been actively involved in making things happen. He is the kind of person who does not like simply to talk about it. At one point, he's going to turn to you and say, "Let's do it." And one of the most influential actions was the creation of Autism Speaks. He knew that it was critical to have a very powerful and influential advocacy agency, one that would really represent the entire community, one that would lobby on behalf of this community.
In terms of his total giving beyond autism, Bernie and his wife, Billy, through the Marcus Foundation, have given away more than $1 billion, with a heavy focus on health issues nationwide and in Atlanta. He's funding traumatic brain injury research at Colorado University, stem cell research at Duke and Georgia Tech, tens of millions of dollars to Atlanta's Shepherd Center to treat veterans and others with spinal cord and brain injuries. And in 2005, he donated $250 million to found the Georgia Aquarium, the largest of its kind in the world and widely credited with helping revitalize downtown Atlanta. Bernie's net worth is north of $4 billion, and he's among the signers of Warren Buffett's Giving Pledge, a commitment by nearly 200 of the world's wealthiest people to give away half their fortunes to charity in their lifetime or in their will. In true Bernie fashion, he's going a step further.
Yeah, Warren Buffett had called me on that, and I had spent a day with Warren Buffett a couple of years before that, and I told him that my foundation is going to inherit 90% of my wealth, not 50%. So when Warren called me and said 50%, I said, "Warren, why such a piker? You know, why don't you just commit to all of your money? You know, leave enough for your kids and that take care of them, but the rest should go to see your foundation and give it away." And he said, "Why don't we just start with 50? So I became one of those that gave 50%. But the truth is 90% of my, and it's in my will and everything else. So it's going to happen that way.
Bernie says it's great that wealthy people have committed to giving away their fortune. But he feels that self-made entrepreneurs who have built something from scratch, like he did, have a bigger obligation than just cutting checks.
Put some of your energy, the energy that helped make you successful, into your philanthropy, because they could use it. There is a nonprofit out there that can't use good management. There is a nonprofit out there that can't use direction. There is a nonprofit out there that doesn't know, that can't handle balance sheets, that don't understand budgeting, that don't understand P&Ls. And philanthropy is a business in many respects. If you don't take enough money in, you can't give the money out. Or if you give the money out and there's no money coming in, there's a little vacuum there. So they should use their skills the way they did. I have to tell you, I'm going strong at 88. I don't feel like I'm 88. I feel like I'm 50, 60 years old. And the reason for it is I'm always involved with something. My mind is constantly being exercised. And I think that keeps people alive. I don't like to see people who are very successful in their lives at 70 years of age that look like they're 90. And they act like they're 107. And a lot of it has to do because they're not interested in what they're doing. They're not getting the enjoyment out of life that they should be getting and could be getting. And I think it's part of an extension. I think it's, you have your business life, and then you have this life that goes after that. That's an extension that could be a very valuable extension.
As I said, I worked at Home Depot and knew Bernie's business story and that he's a generous philanthropist. But what I hadn't realized until recently is that Bernie's entrepreneurial philanthropy is having positive ripple effects well beyond the causes he funds directly. A great example is something called the Homer Fund at Home Depot.
One of our associates had a death in the family, and they couldn't afford to bury. It was their parent. Couldn't afford to bury the parent. And it was, in his life, a tragedy. And he was going to go bankrupt doing this. And he called me for money. And I said, "Don't you have any friends that could help you with the money?" And he said, "I can't ask my friends for anything like this." And I came back and I spoke to Arthur and Kenny. And we talked about it. And we said, "Gee, why don't we form a fund here to take care of our people, things outside of our business? you know, if a mortgage payment is due, a car payment is due, if by mistake somebody is ill and needs money desperately. And so we started it. Each of us gave in a certain amount of money. And we always said that if we could ever get the Home Depot associates to give to it, do you know the number of how many, what percentage of Home Depot associates now give to the Homer Fund?
I bet it's over 80%.
Really? It's over 90%.
Wow.
That is amazing. That is so amazing. And during this last hurricane, it paid for housing.
Since its founding in 1999, the Homer Fund has awarded more than $150 million in relief and assistance grants to Home Depot associates in need. And back to those ripple effects. You might recall last season's episode on the Giving Kitchen, the nonprofit that provides emergency and relief grants to Atlanta restaurant workers. The first time I met with Jen, the co-founder, she said they modeled their program on the Homer Fund after meeting the team there. So, thanks to Bernie's original idea back in 1999, more than 650 members of Atlanta's restaurant community have received more than $1 million in assistance for things like rent, utilities, and other living expenses when personal setbacks like illness or family death occur.
To describe Bernie as a philanthropist is to truly define what are the two sides of his heart. On the one hand, he is a mensch. He is a person who really wants to leave a world in a better shape than the one that he inherited. In the Jewish tradition, we call this tikkun olam, which is to mend the world. He feels he is in this world to mend it, to make it better, particularly for those individuals who are vulnerable and whose families would suffer from genetic or from environmental or from medical vulnerabilities. He wants every child to fulfill their promise. On the other hand, he is a very savvy man, and he believes in leadership. He believes in pivotal accomplishments, and he believes in people that basically share his vision and share his commitment. And together with his business savvy, he wants to make sure that his investments create the kind of momentum that is not only going to ameliorate the condition of children and families, but is really going to transform the world for the next generations of individuals with autism.
I'm Brad Shaw, and thanks for listening to this episode of Crazy Good Turns. Go to crazygoodturns.org to learn more about or donate to the Marcus Autism Center. You can also submit your ideas for extraordinary people or organizations we should feature. And stay connected with us between episodes by following us on Facebook and Twitter. This season, we're excited to announce that we're giving a $50,000 grant to the nonprofit that does the most to creatively spread their Crazy Good Turn story, a virtuous and self-reinforcing circle of gratitude. We'll announce the grant recipient at the beginning of next season. Crazy Good Turns is audio engineered by Stephen Keith. Music supervision and mixing by Score in Los Angeles. Research and editing by Martine Chosar. And a special thanks to Megan Basinger.
We'd like to leave a legacy, my wife and I, where we have really made an impact on the world.